On August 14, The Guardian reported that 19 national heat records have been broken so far this year, and that's an unprecedented number. 3 days before that, The New York Times reported that global warming could, quote, trigger sweeping changes in the natural world that would be hard, if not impossible, to reverse. The examples they cited included the bleaching of the great coral reefs, deforestation in the Amazon rainforest, thawing of the permafrost, collapse of the rotating currents of the Atlantic Ocean, and others. We have precious little time to do what it would take to prevent climate catastrophe of unimaginable proportions. And it might be reasonable to ask, is it even possible? Economist Marty Hart Landsberg argues, yes, it's possible, but not with the approach global leaders are taking today. Marty Hart Landsberg is Professor Emeritus of Economics at Lewis and Clark College. He is the author of 7 books on issues related to globalization and the political economy of East Asia, and numerous journal articles. He is the chair of Portland Rising, a committee of Portland Jobs with Justice, and chair of the Oregon chapter of the National Writers Union. He blogs at Reports from the Economic Front. Marty is here with me today to talk about capitalism and climate change, which he recently wrote about in his blog. Marty Hart Landsberg, welcome to KBOO and to the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you. I'm really pleased to be here with you.
It's generally believed that market forces can be harnessed to control carbon emissions, specifically by moving energy production away from fossil fuels to renewables. Now, in your blog, you argued that market forces aren't working and will not work to affect the changes that we need to make. I'd like to start by asking you about market forces. What do you mean by that? And maybe you could give us some examples of what the Biden administration has been pursuing in order to harness these forces.
So at the heart of the Biden administration has been a reliance on market forces. And what the government hopes to do is to nudge them and get them going. And so it's done that by some tax benefits, some regulatory benefits, and underlying it is the belief that when renewable energy sources get cheap enough, the industry is going to shift on its own and it will become a self-reinforcing process where renewables power our electricity and increasingly our economy. Unfortunately, it's been about 5 years since that change happened, where renewables, solar and wind, have become cheaper than fossil fuels.
And it didn't work.
Well, there's been much more production of renewable energy, but it hasn't led to the reduction of fossil fuel production. And fossil fuel production is what's adding to global warming. So, for example, if you look at just electricity production, the core of it, over 40%, is natural gas. Coal, after it declined for a while, has now stabilized at a pretty high level, 16%, more than solar and wind together. So, what we have is the market has cheapened renewables, and there's more production of them, but they're not replacing fossil fuels. They're just helping to add more energy to meet the demand that's growing.
Well, is that because there just isn't enough of the renewables, or is there something else going on?
The core thing, and what the market analysts say, and the evidence seems very clear, is that the profits to be made in fossil fuel production are double, at least, sometimes triple, the profits to be made for setting up wind farms or solar farms. So the fossil fuel companies are saying it's not worth our effort. It's not responsible to our stockholders to cut our fossil fuel production to go into solar or wind. And as to the reason why that's the case, I mean, there's lots of debates about that, but the market restrictions in fossil fuel production are pretty great. It's hard to just sort of jump in and become a fossil fuel firm. It's relatively easy to try and come in and set up a solar farm or a wind farm, and it's relatively easy to get into the market. And so the banks aren't willing to lend money to these renewable producers because they're really unsure about what's going to happen. So they're lending some, but not a lot, and we're not getting the huge increase. And the fossil fuel companies who are making 10 to 15% returns are saying, we don't want to take our money and go into an industry that's only making 5 to 6% returns. So the market is saying, keep going, keep producing fossil fuels. And even though we're getting more renewables, they're not replacing fossil fuels. So that's one example where we rely on the market and there's some adjustment, but it's not significant enough. I'll just give one other example. And that is a couple of years back, the savior was going to be ESG investing. ESG stood for environment, social, and employment. And the idea was that the financial markets were going to set up these funds. So if you wanted to invest with Vanguard or BlackRock or State Street, you can put your money in an ESG fund and they'll be so attractive and that eventually all the funding will go to companies that are best practice, environment, and so on and so forth. And that's going to lead the economy through the market to reward fund companies who are doing the right thing, protecting the environment. The problem was that who decides what's an ESG fund? Well, they're private rating companies and they make up their own rating. So they would look at ExxonMobil and say, oh, they're doing a great job because they're going paper in their office. I mean, they're getting rid of paper in their office. So isn't that, that's great environment? Or they issued, don't fly quite as much to your corporate meetings, Zoom occasionally. And so as a result, all the oil companies and fossil fuel companies remained in the ESG funds. The rating companies liked it because they were getting paid to rate. The companies themselves liked it because they didn't have to change their practices. And Vanguard and the others liked it because they charged people more for managing their money in an ESG fund. So again, look into the market. What happens? Nothing. There are lots of examples like this where we say the market will handle it, we'll provide a vehicle for investors or companies. And what happens is we continue to pump out fossil fuels.
So it sounds like the stick of climate change simply is no match for the profit motive.
I think that's fair to say. It's not to say that there aren't some changes, but they're not sufficient. And I guess this is really one of the most important parts, which is that when we continue to use fossil fuels, we pump out greenhouse gases, and they can remain in the atmosphere for 100 to 1,000 years. So every time we say, we'll wait for this to happen, we'll wait for this to happen, we're pumping more of these greenhouse gases, which means and what the climate scientists say are that as the concentrations grow, it can take up to a decade to see the higher temperatures. Every year we wait and rely on markets, which have proven not to be sufficient, we're locking in an environment that's going to be more and more inhabitable for us.
So, short of the overthrow of capitalism, which presents its own challenges, what might we do that does not involve market forces toward reducing emissions?
I think one of the things we need to realize is that even though we can do a better job of boosting solar and wind power, we can't replace fossil fuels one for one. We've got to think about reducing our overall energy use because renewables still require certain rare earth metals. They're limited supply. They have to be taken out of the ground, which has its environmental consequences for many countries in the global south. So it's not just boost those up and keep the energy going. We have to figure out a way to reduce our overall energy use and make the transformation. So we've got to dramatically reduce fossil fuels. We have to increase renewables, but it's not going to be one to one. We have to reduce our energy use. So how do we do that in ways that protect the quality of life for most people? And again, it's not that hard to think about it. We need to reduce the production of single-family mansions, of giant sports utility vehicles, of private jets, of luxury cruises, of single-use, products. And also the US military. The US military is the largest greenhouse gas producer in the world. If you start reducing those things, you reduce the amount of energy use. And as you start to increase renewables, you begin to get a surplus of energy that can be directed towards things we really want, like universal health care and better mass transit system and public housing programs and regenerative agriculture. These things sound like they're services, but they come with a lot of job creation. If you build a new healthcare system, you need new clinics, construction. You need things in those clinics, new X-ray machines. You need new vehicles. You need new education systems. If you have electrified, rail, you need to redesign your locomotives. You need to redesign the rail. So there's a lot of job creation that will create an economy that meets people's needs. So the question is, how do you get to that?
That's what I'm wondering. People are not going to give up their SUVs and their McMansions.
They certainly don't want to give it away. I think there are a lot of people who would be willing to say, well, we should stop producing them, but how do we do that? I mean, we've lived so long under a kind of a free market capitalist world that we can't even imagine what a transformation would look like to produce a different economy. And it's challenging because you need to build new industries, you need to expand some existing ones, you need to repress and shut down yet other ones. You need to figure out how to move raw materials around, a whole lot of things, a lot of moving parts. And so it becomes almost overwhelming. And here's where I think history can be very helpful. If you look back to World War II, when the US converted its economy from civilian to military, there are a lot of lessons that can be learned that demonstrate it is not a magic trick to plan and restructure an economy. We've done it. Although back then it was a little bit different challenges than now, they're not as different as one might think. And it's very suggestive of the kinds of things we need to do now and to see that they're doable. It's not something that's unimaginable if we start to get serious about rejecting free market solutions and think about the kind of capacities we need to build.
Well, before you talk about more specifics, during World War II, we really had a very clear and present danger. They talk about tipping points, but maybe there's a different tipping point that we need to take even more seriously, is at what point does the public consciousness of thinking of climate change as a clear and present danger, and we need to do something now. And how do we precipitate that change in attitude? Because right now, I don't think the American public is ready for the kind of command economy that it took to make all those changes during World War II.
I mean, you lay out the challenge really well. Let me respond in a couple ways. One is there's kind of this image that when we hit World War II, we all rolled up our sleeves and we said, let's get it done. And one of the things that's similar to the challenge then, to the challenge we face now, is that US business opposed the restructuring of the economy to fight World War II. They refused to invest. For example, when the US government said we need more steel and aluminum, US business said, we're not going to invest to produce more. How do we know how long the war is going to go? How do we know we're going to win? So they literally would not invest. There were companies like the auto industry that were gobbling up all the resources, and the government said, we need these resources for the military. The auto industry said, it's too profitable. Markets are expanding. We're not going to do that. So the restructuring didn't happen because business said this is a good idea. And if they're not willing to do that in a war, which is, as you say, this is really critical, I don't expect them to do it in this climate crisis where they're making profits. But if people come to understand that a change in structure and system is possible, then the climate crisis becomes different because right now, the way the climate crisis appears to people is do with less and nothing else, right? We're going to cut fossil fuels. So what happens to people who work in the auto industry or in the aircraft industry or the tourist industry? So unless we begin to show and gain confidence that economies, whole systems can be changed to produce a better way of life that's more stable, then people say, yeah, it gets hotter. Maybe I'll use air conditioning more. Maybe I'll just suffer more. But what other choice do I have? Right now, the choice doesn't seem real to people. And so that's where I think the World War II understandings make it possible for people to see this isn't rocket science. You can begin to change an economy. And yes, even then, big business opposed it. So of course they're going to oppose it now. But we didn't accept their opposition then. We don't need to accept their opposition now.
So a big part of that is visioning,
Yes.
making something seem possible.
Yes. And so that's where I think, when we fight for an environment that's livable, we need to make sure that our messaging includes we can't expect, markets to solve the problem. We have to begin to think about planning possibilities. And there are ways of building capacities. For example, the UE, United Electrical Workers, are in the midst of a smart locomotive campaign. Their unions are trying to force locomotive producers to create locomotives that run on batteries that don't pollute. And they're trying to work with environmentalists and government to get that, and environmentalists and government to get the railroads to buy those locomotives. So we need to begin thinking about capacities for planning. Those are big conversations, but that's where the conversation has to go. We have to start developing the confidence that we can do things. So if you look at World War II, we didn't get this transformation magically. It was big government spending on the military. It went from about 2% of GDP in 1940 to almost 40% by 1944. That last year, government spending on the military accounted for half of all the goods produced. Imagine that kind of transformation. Now, how did you get the production? Private investment in 1944 was 37% of the level it was in 1940. They had stopped investing. So what the government did is it created something called the Defense Production Corporation and said, you have an unlimited checkbook. You decide what industries we need, and you go out and you build them and you own them, and you can have a private company manage them. And so the Defense Production Corporation accounted for over 30% of all the investment in the United States during the war. And when the war ended, it owned about 20% of all the new factories that were built in the United States. These were all publicly owned, financed by the US government. So about 70% of all the new capacity was government investment. They didn't wait for the private sector. And as a last part, they didn't just say, let's invest. They also planned the economy because when the military kept saying, we want this and we want that, it created this kind of feeding frenzy for things. So the government came in and said, no, we're going to look at all the key minerals and metals, all the key components, and we're going to plan who gets them. You submit plans to us, what you need. We'll decide which firms will get steel now, which will get aluminum then, which will get machine tools now. They did all that. And as a consequence, the US economy began to run very efficiently, switched gears. Part of the planning was not just build up the military, but they said no more auto production, no more tire production. They essentially planned which industries would shrink because non-military production went down. So the long and short of this is, against the desires of big corporations, we developed planning agencies that went through a series of improvements that allowed us to run an economy, transform that economy, and produce the goods and services we needed to fight the war. If we understand those things, we can start to say, well, if we're going to cut fossil fuels and we want to repress certain industries, how do we make sure that new ones grow, not wait for the market to decide we need these things, but government investment can do it? It's a problem to be studied and a movement to be built for change.
And a big job here that we have is transmitting that vision, making that vision real, elevating examples. Yeah, like you said, waiting for there to be some sort of natural drift. It's just not going to happen.
This is where I think environmentalists and labor needs to start talking. Because again, if you go back to World War II, the UE, for example, towards the end of the war, had a series of conferences in the Midwest where they would invite two people from every department and every firm they owned or represented, African American leaders, religious leaders, to talk about what would planning look like at the end of the war to maintain full employment. And they came up with programs, how to organize whole industries. And so what we need to do is the environmental movement, the housing movement, the labor movement need to start talking about how do we ensure that we have a vision of, like you said before, of an economy that works for us, that's going to be survivable and livable. And let's study some of these lessons and let's talk about what skills we might have now and what capacities.
Well, we are out of time. So, could you tell our listeners, Marty, where they can find your blog?
Sure. If you just Google reports from the economic front, it will pop up and you will see on the blog a sub-tab for publications. And if you click on that, you can tell by the title a number of articles there on planning experience and its contemporary relevance, some of the efforts that unions made back then to think about what a worker-centered planning would look like, the challenges, as you pointed out so well, of building the kind of movement we need.
Thank you very much, Marty Hart Landsberg, for joining me today. We'll have you on again
Well,
sometime.
I appreciate it. Your audience is a good audience to talk with, so thank you for having me.